Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive and the deadly myths which are associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Sometimes they all blend together, all influencing us as one entity. Such is the case this morning with congressmen and senators referring to the Boston Trio, as well as Boston Trio's mommy and daddy, our duo, as well as their parents as radicals. It's nothing but radical, radical this, radical that, as if a radical is the kissing cousin of an extremist. Instead of merely presenting the news, then, this morning, our mission will be to seek understanding so that we can predict how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. And as the case with calling someone a radical as opposed to identifying them as they actually are, which would be a fundamentalist Muslim, a good Muslim, and therefore a terrorist. The government wants to conduct a war on extremism. They want to silence anyone who would speak out against them, who would lift the rug and say, oh my, look at the rubbish that you have tried to conceal under this. And so since they can't blame Al-Qaeda, which would have been a myth, on this terrorist attack. Since there is no way whatsoever to do that this time, all they have up their sleeve is the term radical, and they repeat it as if they were all conspiring together. Our number, if you would like to participate in today's discussion, question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said, is 877-376-45. Before we begin with the first item in the news, we have Nikolai calling in from Wisconsin. My guess, this is probably our friend, Nick, is it not?
Well, I mean, I'm not your enemy.
Okay, it's fine, my friend Nick. You know, my producer Scott, to be fun, wrote it out as Nikolai, and then I saw Nikolai, Wisconsin. My guess is this is probably Nick calling in from Wisconsin. Just a little bit of history. The first time that you called in, I think even the first two times, you were attempting somehow exonerate Mohammed on the charge of being a pedophile. And since that time, we've actually had five or six productive conversations where you have brought up points that were extremely enlightening, appropriate for the conversation. And
I am kicked out from all the Islamic or Muslim groups on my Russian web the sort of Russian version of a Facebook where
okay.
They don't want to talk to me. And also
they don't like evidence and reason when they in fact it's not just the case though, so to be fair here, it's not just the case Nick with Muslims. It is universal amongst the devotees of religion. If you were instead of exposing the true nature of Muhammad at a Muslim site, you were exposing the true nature of Yahusha at a Christian site, they would be as opposed to you as and reject you just as the Muslims do. It's religion as a whole is lives in opposition to evidence and reason. It's destructive to their faith because their faith is not grounded. So what you've experienced is what we all experience when we engage those who are religious.
Well, I know why I was kicked out. So, but the question I have, I know you covered the phrase Allahu Akbar in the previous previous podcast.
Yes.
But you didn't name any of the books or where you were getting all the info from. To where should I address to those who try to?
Allahu Akbar is the Fajr prayer in Islam. It is it means it's the prayer of fear. And what I said is that it was first used for Muhammad's raid on Kabar. by way of background, Mohammed was had signed a 10-year peace treaty with Mecca as opposed to raiding Mecca. And so his militants, not being able to satiate their bloodlust and their covetousness by robbing, stealing, plundering, raping, the Meccans, at least this year, they would come back the next year and renege on Muhammad's promise, peace treaty. Muhammad, rather than take them back to Yathrib, where they would have turned on him, took them to the Jewish farming community of Kabar. And it was there as they approached at dawn that the Islamic prayer of fear, Allahu Akbar, was first uttered. And as you know, it became ingrained in the Islamic psyche. Today, virtually every Islamic terrorist yells Allahu Akbar before they pull the trigger
Where
of their suicide bomb.
Where did
yes.
you read it?
Is
it
so, does it, yes, is so, it yeah, so I'm giving you, that's the background of it. Now, the place that you would find this information is in two places. One is the Sirah. The Sirah is translated into English, if English is your preference, by the Oxford University Press. It's called the Sirah of the Apostle. Sometimes it's referred to as the Biography of the Apostle.
Sirah is big,
Sirah is one tome. It was comprised by, it's hadith, comprised by Ibn Ishaq. It's the first attempt to write down anything about Muhammad is found in the Sirah. Ibn Ishaq was the compiler of it. It was edited and redacted by Hashem, and then it was Oxford University Press of Oxford, England, then provided a translation of it. You would find it, if you want to know all of the resources that I use and the specifics of it, you'll find it in the bibliography of Prophet of Doom. If you go to the Prophet of Doom site and you click on the bibliography, it will give you these specific publication from Oxford University Press that publishes the Sirah. But it's found first in the Sirah, and second, it is also found in the Tariq, which is called the History of Al-Tabari. Al-Tabari was the first to comprise a history of everything that is known about Muhammad and the founding of the Islamic religion. So Al-Tabari also chronicled the same event. Al-Tabari's history, or the history of Al-Tabari, was translated into English and published by SUNY. And SUNY is the State University of New York. So those are the two tomes that the information is found in regarding Allahu Akbar, meaning Allah is greater, the Islamic prayer of fear. And if you're looking for the specific volume, what you would do there is go to Prophet of Doom. The whole book is presented in chronological order. It's in one of the last four or five chapters, the raid on Kabar, but you can, the site has a search engine.
Well, I got my answers. Now, can I make a couple comments about the Chechnya and
sure.
Those bombers?
Yeah.
Earlier on, I told you that the whole reason of me researching the Islam is because mm-hmm. my niece have
converted
into Islam,
right.
Yes, by her
right.
husband.
Yes.
She's fine, and her husband sounds like one of those who didn't read everything about Islam.
Mm,
he's a good Muslim, according to us.
A bad Muslim, according to the Quran, but a good Muslim, according to you. Yeah. Ignorant of the religion.
So
let's hope for your niece's sake he stays that way.
The Chechnya, you... Early on, you told us. I never heard about what you said. You said that the Russians made a deal with the Iranians to so then they would stop. I never heard about that. You're the first one. That sounds like a conspiracy to me. A little.
Yeah, it's not published. It is. Back when I was extremely active in Prophet of Doom, I had the opportunity to talk with people in the intelligence community around the world, as well as particularly intelligence communities in Europe and in the Middle East. Prophet of Doom was such a groundbreaking book that those who were in the know almost universally said, you know, don't ascribe my name to this because I'll lose my job. But this is the most magnificent, eye-opening book ever written on Islam. Everything you said here is precisely true. It's an amazingly important tool. And then we would begin to have dialogue. Many of these people actually came to my home to speak. And several of them spoke of the same events and gave insights as to how I could verify what they were saying. That immediately after the Veselin Grammar School bombing and the several four or five hospital bombings and then the Moscow theater bombing, all perpetrated by Chechnyan Muslims, I was told that that Putin was on the ropes in terms of his ability to control Russia, because the Russians were looking for someone who could protect them from this Chechnyan Islamic onslaught. And so Putin was put in a position whereby he had to keep control of Chechnya. It wasn't, you know, so many of the Russian, the former Russian states, they were allowed to go independent. But the Chechnyan region, Dagestan, could not go independent without the Russians losing access to the Caspian Sea natural gas and oil reserves, which required
Chechnya is two different solitary regions of the Russia.
But the region that Chechnya and Dagestan are in is the region immediately adjacent to the Caspian Sea, and the Caspian Sea is where the gas, the largest untapped natural gas and oil reserves are in the world. And so the reason that the Russians and the Chinese are in lockstep with the Iranians, why they're supporting Syria, why they're supporting Iran, and all running cover for them and on their nuclear program and cover for them on international sanctions and running cover for them in Syria is because they have built elaborate pipelines that run through that area, and that is a huge part of their economy. And so the Russians work to deal with the Iranians to say, you... Back with the Shattering Myths. We have Nick calling in from Wisconsin. Nick said that the only place that he had heard of the agreement that had been reached between Putin and Russia and the Ayatollah and Iran to stop funding massive Islamic terrorist attacks through the Chechnyan Muslims in lieu of the Iranian government getting Russian support to run cover for its nuclear ambitions as well as for its ambitions to be the supreme power in the Middle East, therefore being able to control both Iraq and Syria. And so let me provide you just a bit of background on I've told you how I heard about it, which is not one of those situations where I can give you a chapter and verse in terms of the individual's names, because they asked me to keep their identity secret. But here's the reality of it. What you can do is just look at the record. In 2002, 50 Chechnyans took 850 individuals hostage in the Moscow theater. 170 people were killed. It was one of the worst terrorist attacks, Islamic terrorist attacks in modern history. 2 years later, in 2004, the single worst, most vicious, most savage Islamic terrorist attack in history, at least in modern history, took place in the Beslan school, where 1,100 hostages were taken by the Chechenian Muslims. 777 of them were children, grammar school-age children. 380 were killed. Putin was on the ropes. Since that time, there has not been a single massive terrorist attack of this nature in Russia. And since this time, Russia has been the primary stalwart of Iran, enabling Iranian ambitions.
Yes, but that, I mean, if that's what is true, then according to you, all those terrorist attacks stopped because of no more support coming from the Iran. But that would mean that Putin defeated the all those terrorists that was in Russia, and I don't think he did, because right now in Russia is, well, de facto law is what's the law supposed to be on the paper in Russia, which is not the Sharia. But my mom is, for example, afraid to go visit her grandkid because she thinks they'll start throwing rocks at her if she'll show up in her pants.
Yeah, what you're taking is you're taking it to an extreme. The deal was just to have the Iranians stop funding the massive operations that were being perpetrated inside of Russia. That did happen, and we have not seen a massive Chechenian Islamic terrorist attack in Russia now in 9 years. Now, what would have been impossible to do and was not part of the agreement was to eliminate Islam in the Caucasus region in Chechnya. That has not occurred. And Chechnyans.
That's where the Putin could come in with an army.
That won't work.
You eliminate all the support for the.
That doesn't work.
Can't you enforce the law then?
Yeah, that's what Putin tried initially. His initial tactic was when the Chechenian Muslims became vicious and became terrorists, beginning by hijacking airplanes. They were called the Black Widows, and then by bombing hospitals.
That's what he failed to do from beginning, but now he shouldn't have no problems of doing so because there's no support coming from outside, from what you say.
Yeah, that's the Iranian support has dried up. That is true. But the reality is, listen to this thought here. What Americans should have learned when we invaded Afghanistan and Iraq is that you cannot confront a religious opponent with bullets and bombs. When you attack a religion with bullets and bombs, you strengthen it. You do not weaken it, because you strengthen the resolve of those individuals to fight. Now, without the Iranian support, the Muslims in Chechnya are unable to perpetrate the large terrorist attack where they would send 50 to 100 people to do an act, and while they cannot successfully defend themselves against the Russian army, the reality is that Russians' invasion there with the tanks, all that does is make Russia. To Shattering Myths. We still have Nick on the line. The reason that this topic is of interest to Nick, of course, is because of his background and his niece's background. And the reason the topic is interesting to me is that Yahweh, which is God's name, has a great deal to say about our immediate future, and the fact that the Chechenians would gain an Islamic coalition in the Caucasus regions, and that as a result of that uh, of very fundamental and zealous Islam in that region. They would join with Muslims from Pakistan and Afghanistan, and then Muslims from Iraq and Iran, and then with Muslims surrounding Israel from Turkey and Egypt and Libya, and collectively they would attack Israel in unison within a matter of months of the time of promising peace. So it's very much like the story behind the Islamic prayer of fear. These are all related things, because just as Muhammad signed a peace treaty with the Meccans in the following year, came back and conquered Mecca, and in the meantime came up with the Islamic prayer of fear, which is to say that the Islamic God Allah is greater than the God of the Yehudim, the Jews, Yahweh. The Chechenian region is going to be the place where all of this is going to gain the initial zeal. Nick, one of the things that Putin's a pragmatist. I mean, Putin, I think, is an evil man, but he is a pragmatist. One of the things I think he realizes is that so long as he controls Dagestan and Chechnya in terms of can have his pipelines run through it and has access to the Caspian Sea, that and so long as Chechenian Muslims aren't killing hundreds of Russian citizens in places like Beslan and Moscow, then that is probably as good a standoff as he can achieve. Now, the last time the Russians went in with and actually conducted war, which is to what you are suggesting he could wipe out the Chechenian resistance, was in 2009. That occurred because of the fact that the Chechenian, it was 1999, the Chechenian Muslims invaded Dagestan. In fact, the Chechenian group was called the Islamic International Peacekeeping Brigade, and they invaded Dagestan, and that's what caused Putin to respond with his military. And in that conflict, the Russians lost 11,000 soldiers. There were 50,000 Chechenian Muslims killed. And that is the kind of carnage that when you have 11,000 of your own troops killed, that causes people to oppose one's political aspirations. It's what led significantly to the decline of the Soviet Union before it became fascist, with the killing of Russian boys in Afghanistan. And so the last thing Putin wants to do is sacrifice another 11,000 of his soldiers trying to rid a place of religion. So I don't think that he's going to go back and invade Chechnya unless his hand is forced.
Russia does fight for that because of the resources that there. But that's that's natural. I mean, America does the same thing.
Of course, I'm not.
You get the oil, whatever you do, you prep. Who do you think will sell it to you? Or in our case, you try to hold on to the territory. What Putin failed to me is to establish law, regular, normal law that works in everywhere else in Russia. And if he failed it with the help from Iran or without the help of Iran, that tells me that Iran have not much of anything to do with it. I mean, yes, there is less of, not less, but almost none of the bombings, so Iran stopped subsidizing those big people. But still, he failed with or without. I mean, that's like a war with no winning. How did he win the war?
Yeah, well, you can't win a war against religion. That's that is the bottom line. I think Putin recognizes, the United States at this point doesn't recognize it.
You can slow down the rate of growth.
You can't. Like when America invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, we accelerated the growth of the religion. We did not slow it down.
Yeah, no, you can't do it with the bullets and the tanks. But propaganda, in my mind, does everything else. You use FSB, which is working in Russia, or CRU here by funding those who wants to have their own radio station, who don't really mind dying if somebody will, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you fund those people, and they will open up the eyes to those who, that's how
you win. You can't win, but you can certainly slow them down in terms of good intelligence. The Russians are reasonably good at that. That's the reason why the Russians knew Tamerlane was a ticking time bomb. And that's why they not only told the FBI, but also our CIA, that he was a ticking time bomb, because they their intelligence was aware of his mindset, where he was going and what he was doing and what he was thinking. And so the Russians are reasonably good at that. I would challenge you on something that, having spent a lot of time in Russia, and you may have as well, but Russia is a country that is somewhat similar to the Russia back in the communist days, and that all they really have done is they've replaced communism with fascism, and that freedoms in Russia and the rule of law is pretty much illusionary. If you are not part of the oligarchy, if you are not part of the Russian ex-KGB mob that now controls the country, Putin will throw you in jail and you will never see the light of day. That country is as close to being a dictatorship as a country can be without the official title. The
and
press, everything
like,
is controlled
like China,
by Putin.
Just like China, it is. But in the Putin's main the reason why he wants to control the Chechnya because of the resources there, and the reason why he can't control it because of the religion. So the common sense would be to have a propaganda work, I mean, to support, to prep those who wants to talk about, who wants to speak out, who wants to, I mean, they will do his bidding. Why is he not doing it?
I think a lot of history says that propaganda works when you have a receptive audience. In America, propaganda is ubiquitous. We are blaming, for example, the Boston bombing on radicalization as opposed to fundamentalist Islam. And when you have an audience that is willing to receive propaganda, and when their government fails them, they're actually singing songs to their government, that works. The problem in Chechnya is that the Russian Federation isn't going to sing the songs that Muslims in Chechnya want to hear, and there really isn't a patriotic fervor in Russia, because most people know that Putin has become a fascist dictator. The thing that actually works against religion is something that Putin would never, in the life of him, consider using. I mean, there's one thing that works against religion, and that is evidence and reason. And when a society universally uses evidence and reason to expose the failings of religion, it becomes almost impossible for the religion to continue to promote itself. But that is not something that most people are willing to deploy against religion.
I don't quite agree with you there, because you said it won't work without the public willing to listen to you. But it's not that hard to acquire the public. You don't start with 24/7 bashing the Islam. You start with something they like, they would listen to. Just once in a while, you throw in, "Hey, I don't like Islam. Anyone would like to argue with me, please join me at 2 o'clock on a Sunday or whatever." I can guarantee you there will be a whole bunch of them listening to you at that moment, because obviously they want to know why do you not like, and a whole lot other reasons. There's strategies on how to acquire a public, how to grow your numbers in terms of listening public. And so
it's the strategy that Paul used. He to each group of people,
why not to use the strategy to destroy or at least
because the strategy is Machiavellian. It's what we call the strategy today, which is the ends justifies the means, because it's immoral. That's why we don't use the strategy. Now, you can. Strategy is used.
Look like Putin is a moral person. Like,
that's right.
He is
Putin could use the strategy, except for the fact that Putin doesn't really care that life is hell for the Chechens. It's not of interest to him. The fact that they're destroying one another and they have no viability is not so long as they're not killing Russians and he doesn't care. And in terms of someone like myself who could wield the truth, we aren't going to be Machiavellian. We are not going to use the Pauline strategy of being a chameleon and pretending to be something that we're not, and other to garner an audience. It is an immoral strategy.
You're saying you wouldn't do it, and
right.
Well,
I wouldn't do
it. I'm not you, and like we started, and from what we started, I'm not your enemy, but I wouldn't mind to use that strategy, and I'm so sure that Putin wouldn't mind to use that strategy either. And if both of us have the same goal, isn't that
that's Sun Zhu's strategy. And by the way, this whole conversation, Nick, is really useful. I mean, we are engaging in a discussion in terms of how to deal with the enemies of humankind. Religion is probably mankind's greatest enemy, his greatest foe, and particularly when religion and politics mix as they are in Russia and the Chechnyan regions, and how you go about combating that. The conversation that we're having, I think, is extraordinarily useful. So first, I want to congratulate you on sponsoring this, and we'll even continue it after the break. But the Sun Zhu strategy, that you just mentioned, is also Machiavellian and immoral, and it is the strategy that has been used to the detriment of America for the last 100 years. It is what. Hello, welcome back to Shattering This. We're having a discussion with Nick calling in from Wisconsin, who has a personal stake in what's happening in Russia and Chechnya and with Islam as a whole. Nick, I think you have begun to realize that Islam is a horrible foe. Muslims, if you look at the Islamic countries in the world, they're the most impoverished, the least free, and most savage places on earth to live, and that Muslims commit 99% of the terrorist acts in the world. So the question is, how do you then combat this horrible foe of humanity? And the two strategies that you have listed, the first was the Machiavellian, which is the ends justify the means. And the second is from Sun Tzu's Art of War, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Let me share with you some of the consequences of deploying that strategy from an American point of view. America, during Second World War, decided that because the Soviets were fighting Hitler, that we should supply tanks and other weapons to the Soviet Union, so that because they were the enemy of our enemy, we viewed them as our friend. And after the war was won in against Hitler, the Soviet Union imposed a more hellish situation on Europe than even Hitler had previously. And so by using that strategy, we unleashed 20 years of hell on Eastern Europe. In that same war, we decided, because Mao Zedong was willing to fight the Japanese, that we would also arm and equip him. And as a result of that, he overpowered Chiang Kai-shek after the war, and he was responsible for the deaths of 40 million Chinese. It unleashed a more hellish condition. The United States, once lost favor in Iran, turned to Iran's enemy, Iraq, and we provided Iraq with weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons. And then after using the enemy of our enemy as our friend, We ended up invading Iraq not once, but twice at terrible loss of life. In Afghanistan, America decided that since the Pakistani Taliban and this and Al-Qaeda, which was working with them, was the enemy of the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan, that we could use the enemy of our enemy as our friend, and we provided them with $5 billion worth of money and weaponry. And we created the very enemy that that ravaged hell on the world and the United States thereafter. And so the strategy of viewing the enemy of your enemy as your friend, the Shen Tzu strategy from the Art of War, has caused more hellish consequences than it has resolved. So not a very good strategy either.
In another word, every time you try to help someone, they turn around and they bite you in the behind.
Well, it all depends on who you are trying to help, and that's why it is.
So far, everyone you did help.
You know, in fact, it's one of those things that. In fact, Nick, it's interesting. I was writing this this morning as I was editing a book that I wrote called Questioning Paul, which exposes and condemns Paul as a false prophet. And one of the things that that Christians all believe is that salvation is God's goal, that he wants to save everyone, and that's not true. And this gets right to your point. If you try to help people that are the wrong people to help, you actually create a bigger mess than you would have started. So if God tried to save people who were opposed to him, he would actually create a mess. And that's why salvation is not God's priority. It's a byproduct of the covenant. God only attempts to help his covenant children. It doesn't attempt to help anyone else.
Well,
and that's why he doesn't do it, is because it creates a bigger mess than you started with.
Well, at the moment, I'm not fighting for the God.
I know. And that is our difference, my friend, because, and excuse me if I use the term friend inappropriate, but what I've come to like you, Nick. I've come to respect you. I've come to enjoy our conversations. And so I do like you. And I know that our primary difference is that everything that I do is guided and motivated by what I know about Yahweh, and I even do the first hour of this show for that express purpose, and it's why I can't and won't use the Machiavellian strategy of the end justifies the mean, or the Sun Tzu strategy of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But I have to tell you, I hope you do call in again. This has been a marvelous hour of discussion with you, Nick. And my hope is that your niece's husband doesn't treat her like Tamerlane treated his wife, calling her a whore and prostitute, beating her, and ultimately enslaving her.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that